I'll bring you in. I'll just wait a minute. So we'll just see if we're on this tape. And the last tape, I asked you why you came round through the canal to Victoria, spent 3 months here, and then went back to Halifax again, and you said it was showing the flag.
More or less, right.
We've been taking a coffee break, and you've been telling me about the breakwater in front of your property here, and we reminded each other that two of the things we were taught as junior officers was, one, do something even if it's wrong, and two, an officer's job is to make decisions. You told me that when you were reeve of Esquimalt, which you were for how many years?
14.
For 14 years. The engineer came along and said that he had the chance to get some rock cheaply, and I've forgotten the name of the engineer and how the story goes from
John
there.
John Graham was the engineer.
John Graham said what to you?
He said, we have to make a decision right away on this matter. I've worked out the cost of it. We can have the rock at $5 a cubic yard in place, and it'll cost $50,000. And we can build it from Macaulay Point rather than farther in where we planned to build one if we ever had the money for it. And I had to make up my mind then and there, because Chew Excavating had this rock at the site of the now museum and archives, and he just had to get rid of it. So nobody knew but John Graham and myself that the deal had gone through, and I told him to conclude the deal with Chew Excavating, the contractor, dump the rock, and so it was done that very same day.
Well, you should really have got the council together and got permission to... You said to him, I haven't got authority to spend $50,000.
Spending $50,000, I wasn't authorized to do that at all, and I would have to get the council together. And he said to me, well, then the deal is off. But when he said that, I knew that I had to make up my mind, so I said, well, go ahead, John.
And subsequently, you got the council together? And
then I got the council together, and I said, well, now, although we're depositing rock in the sea, we're not entitled to do that. We have to get authority for this, and I'd like to... the department in Ottawa to share the cost with us. They built the Oak Bay breakwater for nothing, and surely this is a life-saving project, and surely they'd share it 50-50, and I'd like to take the engineer with me down to Ottawa and ask for this. And they said they agreed to this, they agreed to what we'd done, and we're very happy. And so John Graham and I went down to Ottawa, and we asked the minister about this, and he said, oh yes, you have permission to dump the rock in the sea, I can see that, but what's the commercial value? And I had to admit that there was no commercial value at all, but from a life-saving point of view, this was necessary. And he said, what money are you talking about? And I said, I'm just talking about $50,000, and I'd like you to pay $25,000, and we'll pay $25,000. And he said to me, you're talking peanuts. I'll get this through the treasury quite easily, and he did. So we had our breakwater built for $25,000.
And then you said that was the way you got your job as, when they asked you to run as councilman.
Yes, when I talked to my wife about this, and I said, I think now that I've left the Navy, might be a nice thing if I stood for council without any remuneration. I wouldn't want any remuneration, but I'd like to stand for council. And she said, oh, I think this would be a nice idea. So I found that there was a vacancy for a one-year term. It was just one opponent, and so we were required to meet at a ratepayers meeting, and I told the ratepayers that I had no knowledge of municipal affairs whatsoever, no knowledge of provincial affairs, but I hoped my executive experience in the Navy would stand me in good stead, and I got elected.
And so it proved. So yeah. Between councilman and Reeve, how many years?
6 years, so I spent 40 years old, or 20 years altogether.
20 years altogether?
Yeah.
That's a good insight on naval training in in subsequent years.
But the funny part about it was this fellow who was standing against me, he, when he had to appear before the ratepayers, told the ratepayers that he thought the present council weren't doing their job, and that if he was elected, he would be there at 5 o'clock, and he would see that things were run a bit differently from the way they were being run at present. I listened to this, and I knew that all the backers of the then council would be very mad about this, and I would get their vote, and that's the way it turned out to be.
Well,
so my opponent got me elected.
Well, that was very astute of you. I think your own worth got you elected too. It certainly turned out to be that way.
Oh,
I
yeah.
know the high esteem in which you're held, in, not only in Esquimalt today, but the whole of the area. Mm. When we had lunch the other day, everybody was stopping at the table to shake your hand and say hello, including the number one bureaucrat, Laurie Wallace.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Well, to go back 40 years, where were you? You were...
I went to the Baltic in the Cleopatra.
Aren't you back in...
I came back to Canada.
Yeah, you're back in Canada. You steamed around here. The two destroyers steamed around here for 3 months, then back through the canal to Halifax.
Yes.
Patriot and Patrician.
And then...
And you're first lieutenant of...
No, I wasn't first lieutenant, I was sub of the...
You were the sub of...
Patrician.
Of Patrician. And her captain was...
G.C. Jones.
G.C. Jones. Yes. Why was he called Jetty Jones?
The troops felt that his ship was the Ottawa, I understand, and they felt he should be going to sea. But he couldn't go to sea, poor fellow, and be officer in charge at Halifax. He had quite a job to do there. I think so.
Yes, so he had to stay alongside and run the command.
Yeah.
Was he in command of the Halifax area?
Yes, he was.
As what rank? Commander?
No, he was a captain.
He was a captain then. Yeah. And so... He had to keep his destroyer alongside and run the command from his destroyer.
She went to sea.
Oh, yes, but not as often as the troops would have liked, I guess.
They would like him to have gone to sea.
Yeah.
He would like to have gone to sea, too.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
But who was ashore in Halifax then in those years? We're up to about 1921 now, aren't we? I mean, there were troops ashore.
Yes.
And officers.
Yes, there weren't very many troops in 21 at all. When we commissioned the Patriot and Patrician in Aurora, we had to sign on RN ratings.
Did you?
Yeah, quite a number of them.
Oh, yes.
Few of our own.
You mentioned those to me. They weren't really career ratings in the Royal Navy. They sent us out some one-year men, did they not?
When the Niobe came along, when the Niobe and the Rainbow came out, they were on a 2-year engagement, and then they went back, most of them.
Were they 7-year hitch men in the Royal Navy?
I don't think so.
Just in the Royal Navy for 2 years?
Yeah, they were attached to the Niobe was in Canadian Navy, and I think they were paid Canadian Navy rates, I'm not sure.
Yes.
And they were sent out on a 2-year engagement, and then a lot of them went back. And we recruited a number of men at that time. Quite a number deserted. The Navy was alongside a great deal of her time. All the time I was in Naval College, she was lying alongside. She'd gone aground at Cape Sable, and Cornwall told her off and brought her into Halifax, and she had boiler trouble too, and so she didn't go to sea for quite a long time. I understand later on she did a good job off New York.
Off New York, yes. There were a lot of German ships in there that were trying to break out and get away. And she was patrolling off there. Then, of course, there was Admiral Hose's small boat force on the East Coast towards the end of the war.
Yeah.
I think he had up to 40 patrolling the coast.
Little things.
Well, that I can't seem to go on in time. I keep going back. So now, back
to the RN after we arrived at Halifax.
So you went back to the Royal Navy
to do my courses.
To do which courses? Subs courses.
Well, see, I passed in seamanship in the Caesar.
Yeah.
And then we had to do a course for lieutenant in navigation and gunnery and in torpedo.
Yes.
And I hadn't done that, my term hadn't done that, so we were sent off to the RN to do these courses.
And you did those courses where?
Whale Island and Vernon. And at the navigation school in the dockyard at Portsmouth.
Yes.
The Vernon was a funny outfit in those days. There were three old ships of the line moored up in Fairham Creek.
Yes.
And these were the real old sailing ships there,
yes,
with no room between decks. Even I, a little squirt, bumped my head going between the ships.
Well, I guess.
But later on, the Vernon was moved ashore.
Yes. HMS Excellence started the same way. She was a hulk up Fairham Creek in the 1800s.
Yes.
The Queen Charlotte. Did you go to Greenwich, the Royal Naval College?
No, I never went there. The engineers went there.
Yeah.
I think there were some executive officers that went there too.
Yeah. So you did your sub-lieutenant's courses, and then what?
Then I went off to the Malaya. I was sent to the Malaya. Dick Hart and I were sent off together to the Malaya.
Yeah.
Another great towering fellow called Percy Royds.
R-O-Y-D-S. R-O-Y-D-S, yeah.
Yeah.
Who was he?
He didn't care for Canadians very much, and he felt that he didn't realize we'd been through Naval College the same as the RN in Michigan. We'd done the same training, and so he was loath to let these sub-lieutenants take charge when they should have been. So we had a little difficulty with him.
He was the captain of Malaya.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, then he left the ship, and there was Turkish trouble on about that time. We were sent out to Constantinople in the Malaya.
Yes.
I was there for only a very short time, and in those days, the great many of the RN ships burnt coal, and they would ask for assistance when they were coaling from the ships of burnt oil. And I was sent over in charge of a coaling party from Malaya. I came back to the ship filthy dirty, only to be handed the signal saying I was to return to Canada forthwith. The headquarters didn't know I was way over Constantinople at this time, so I had to travel overland and back to Canada. The Admiralty weren't particularly pleased because the Geddes Acts had come in about this time, and a whole lot of RNs had been demobilized, they were let out. And so they had to send somebody out in my place because I was a permanent officer in the Malaya. I had, I think, a turret I had.
You had a turret, yes.
I had a division there too. As far as I remember, I had the quarterdeck division, which was a curious thing because generally the officer in charge of quarterdeck division was also the officer in charge of
Y turret. Yeah. Well, there's no figuring that one out.
No, I don't know. I don't know to this day. Anyway, back I came, and the idea of this was that the RCNVR and RCNR were starting up at this time, and they had allocated three officers to get this going. There was the H.J.F. Hibbert, he was the eldest of the Hibbert boys, there were three Hibbert boys, and he was to organize this with this CNS at Ottawa, and Richard Owen was to take charge of the West Coast, and I was to take charge of the bunch on the East Coast. And we had nothing to go on at all. We had to work on our own program, except that I knew when I had a stoker or an engine room rating of some kind, I could turn those over to the engineer officer. But I never did until they'd done their boat pulling in the morning. I always insisted it didn't matter whether they were labeled themselves petty officers or who they were, they had to pull a boat. So at 6:30 or 6:15 or whatever it was, when the hands turned two, they learned how to pull a boat. I think this was good value.
Presumably after a cup of coffee and a piece of hardtack, the same as you got.
No, we didn't get anything. They went straight down to the boat.
Oh, well.
Nothing but fun.
Things are getting even worse.
Yeah.
Was this after Admiral Hose had set up the naval divisions across Canada?
Yeah. Well, this was it.
This was it.
Yeah. So we had all the troops from, I suppose, Fort William east. Fort William was, and Port Arthur were the west. But from there east was my law. So I had the Montreal bunch and I had the Quebec bunch.
And do you remember how they were set up?
They were set up in companies and half companies.
Yeah, how we got the property, who was appointed in command and so on?
Gentlemen would volunteer to look after a half company or a company. And they would be lawyers or other businessmen, and they took charge of the company. They gave their time free.
Yes. Well, had they naval experience?
No. Most of them had no experience whatsoever. And so they had to learn to pull a boat and take charge of a boat, too. I had a funny experience with a chap called Colbrow and another fellow called Pettigrew. Wanted to, when they came to Halifax, live at Armadale, which was 2 or 3 miles away from the barracks, and they figured they couldn't get in by 6:30 in the morning, and they weren't going to do this. So I said, well, you can see the commander about this. And commander was Commander Brabant at that time. He looked at them and he said, you're down here to learn how to take charge of a boat. You'll be in at 6:30 in the morning.
Brabant is B-R-A-B-A-N-T.
Yeah.
And this is not the LJM Govrow of the Naval College. This is another Govrow.
No, that's another Govrow. This is his brother, I guess.
Perhaps, yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Anyway, they didn't like this, so they went back to Quebec.
And
did, well, I didn't have it.
You did not take it. They did not take over, huh?
But they objected to my attitude. They thought I was dictatorial.
Well, yeah.
Reported that Govrow said that Pettigrew said, oh, that word will, we sent him to Angleterre.
Oh dear. What else about the beginning then of the RCNVR, really?
That was the beginning of the RCNVR.
I think the Royal Navy wanted it called the Royal Naval Canadian Volunteer Reserve.
Yes.
RNCVR.
There was a Royal Naval Canadian Volunteer Reserve, RNCVR.
Yeah.
And that flourished fairly well, I understand, on the West Coast, but it wasn't in existence when they started up again. I remember the first lot we had, I had nothing to go on at all, but I determined that these young fellows should be taught seamanship, and we hadn't much of a staff. We had a petty officer, and we had a gunner's mate to show them how to march around parade ground properly. We had no seamanship instructor other than Petty Officer Ireland, and he was my right-hand man, and that was about it. We didn't even have our own writer. We shared the writer with the main office. So I had to write out all my own orders and this sort of thing and try and figure out how to deal with this. And first class, I arrived, I think it was in May, we had a list of who was coming, but you never could depend on these lists at all. And they used to come in somewhere about midnight in the ocean limit, and so you would have to be there when they arrived to find out who they were. And we also had to find out what their religion was and what their age was. We had to find out what their age was because it was thought improper that a chap of 20 should be called an ordinary seaman. So they were, if they were 20, they were made acting AB, and they got 10 cents more a day. But it was curious, they never twigged this. They could have got 10 cents more a day just by saying that they were 20, but they always said they were these milk or these wheat, you know.
Yeah.
And you'd have to go through the whole list, and I discovered right away that by asking what their age was, they wouldn't answer to that, so I'd always say, Kilage, you know, and then I'd get the answer, these wheat. However, this backfired a little. The first division, next morning, Petty Officer Ireland had to muster the troops. It was always done in those days. I don't know whether they do it today, but anyway, you always mustered the troops of divisions. And Petty Officer Ireland didn't speak a word of French, and he didn't understand it, so he started reciting their names, and he got no answer. Well, rightly so, because Oulette was called Oletti, and Simard was called Simard, and Bouffard was called Bouffard, and there were three Bouffards, and so it went on till the end. His hat got farther and farther, cap got farther and farther back on his head as he scratched his head over all this, and he thought he'd got the last one. The last one was Leroux, but it wasn't in English, it was Lahurieux.
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 Lahurieux, yeah.
So, well, there was also a Lemieux, and this was Lemieux.
Lemieux.
Yeah, yeah. So he came to me afterwards, and he said, seemed to be all there. You reported there seemed to be all there. Well, there was 16 out in front of him, and he had read 16 names, but none of them answered their name. And he said, do I have to do this, because I really can't pronounce the name? I said, Petty Officer Ireland, they're here to do naval training. They have to do things in a naval way. We just have to stomach this, we've had to go on. So the next day, they all had English names, the Hurriux was still the Hurriux, but the difference was that they all answered to their names the next day. And what Petty Officer Ireland had done to them in the meanwhile, I'll never know.
He'd obviously said something.
Anyway, by the time they'd done their fortnight, they knew to do how to do almost everything with a bit of rope, and with a bit of, they could do even canvas work a little. And they all knew how to pull a boat. Unfortunately, I had to teach them boat pulling. There was nobody else to do this. I also had to teach them physical jerks. There was nobody to teach them physical jerks. The report got through to Ottawa. That Wirtle, he ran like Renard. whether I did or not, but they said they certainly had to do their physical jerks all right. Boat pulling was another thing. I remember the first day we had 12-oared cutter, and we shoved off from the jetty, and I thought, my God, how will I ever get back to the jetty again? You know, they didn't know anything about an oar. They didn't know the loom from the blade. However, they knew how to pull a boat by the time they finished.
And they went back to their division.
Yeah, and they were very happy. They went back with $25, which was quite something in those days.
Yes, it would be, yes.
Got the boat right, 14 times $1.75. Mm-hmm. Well, not quite, though.
We'll let somebody else work that out. We're not very good at our...
21 or something.
Not good at our gazintas, either of us.
Of course, if they're ordinary, it seemed they only got $1.65 a day.
So there you are, the three of you running the RCNVR.
Yeah, yeah. We had, with that group, we had six young fellows from St. John, and they were dandy fellows. They cottoned on to things right away, and they were very smart. And so it went on through that year, and I did this for over 2 years in Halifax. And then I was sent back to the RN again.
So here you are, let's say 1925.
Early 1925, I guess, possibly.
And where did you go in the RN?
I went to the HMS Ramillies.
Ramillies, oh, you're a big ship man, all right, aren't you? Malaya, yeah. Ramillies.
And there again, sometimes when you're sent over to the RN, you were regarded as supernumerary and you did watchkeeping, that sort of thing. But most of my time in the RN, I was a permanent officer because there was a shortage.
To get his act.
A shortage in the Ramillies, and so I had a turret and I had the forecastle division there.
Well, they fixed that up for you. You didn't have to go all the way aft to see your men.
No.
Did you do firings in Ramillies?
Yes, we did. But I was not there very long because the intelligence officer at Halifax persuaded the department that he'd been there 3 years and that the only fellow who could take his place was Alf Wirtle. And I don't know why this was done at all, but after less than 6 months in the Ramillies, I was sent for and made intelligence officer.
Of Ramillies?
No, of in Halifax.
Back to Halifax?
Yeah.
Gosh, you moved around a lot?
Yeah. Well, this rather annoyed me because it didn't amount to very much intelligence in those days. You had to keep tab of shipping. You had to go around to the customs officers to teach them how to use a code in case of wartime they'd have been required to use this. Other than that, there was nothing very much for an intelligence officer to do. And whereas Rupe Wooden was married and he used to come in civilian clothes into the dockyard, he was supposed to take on as watchkeeper because we only had three watchkeepers, that's all. But he would shift into his uniform in the evening, and then a little later on in the evening he'd go ashore because Alfred wasn't married and I'd look after him. His job for the night.
So you were watch on and stop on?
Yeah.
Who's this
no,
Roof?
Not quite, because we did have fellows like Billy Holmes and Gus Miles who came in there, and Godfrey Hibbard was there too, and Harry Soldier, first lieutenant for a good deal of time too.
Who was this Roof? I didn't get his name.
Rupert Wood?
Oh, Rupert Wood, yeah.
He used to do this job. He seemed to know something about it. It seemed to be down his alley, but Massey Goulden was our captain at that time, and I went to him when I arrived there, and I said, I don't want to be in civilian clothes. I want to take my part as an officer of the barracks. And he said, well, that's fine. So I was PT officer, secretary of the wardroom mess, and I did watchkeeping and any other jobs that fall to an executive officer in the barracks.
You're a lieutenant now, aren't you?
Yes, I'm a lieutenant now.
Massey Goulden is a Royal Naval officer. How did he get in?
He came out in the rally at one time. The rally went ashore. That wasn't his fault. The Straits of L.I. They never did get her off. And then he was American West Indies Squadron. And he had met a Mrs. Rogers out here. He was the Rogers who ran the sugar firm out here. And they were married later on. I remember I went on board as officer of the guard one day when he was in one of these RN ships. And he was very insistent about my getting a telegram off to Mrs. Rogers. And this was at the time he was thinking of getting married to Mrs. Rogers. Well, whether this was a proposal or what it was, but I saw the thing off, and it wasn't long after that that they were married. And I had known Paul Blythe Rogers. We went to school together. It's an old school in Brockville.
Which Rogers is this? Him? B.L., what's his name?
Blythe Rogers.
B.L.Y.T.H.?
Yeah.
Well, who's Mrs. Rogers? Well,
Mrs. Rogers was Mrs. Massey Goulden. I think she was a Chernyavsky, I'm not sure. I've forgotten what her maiden name was.
Well, Massey Goulden couldn't have married her.
Well, Blythe Rogers died.
Oh, I see. She's a widow. Okay.
Yeah, he was a widow.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Hopefully legal.
Well, I'm sure it was, but I just didn't quite understand.
Yeah, oh, sorry. I didn't explain myself well.
No, but you do explain yourself well. It's my fault. There's a whaler steaming by.
Yeah.
I think it's a whaler, is it? No.
No, I don't.
No, it's not got this after sail up, anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway,
later on, I was when I went to Halifax, the intelligence officer, he was in command. So
he must have He was on loan then to the RCN.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, I see.
Yes.
Because his daughter is married to a friend of mine, George Nation, and
yes, that's right.
He's just recently given me some of Massey Goulden's books, which I've given to the library at Royal Roads.
Well, he had a tremendous number of books. He gave a lot to Hugh Henderson.
Yes.
Hugh Henderson has a library of books there.
Well, what was left was given to his daughter, the wife of my friend, and
was she Miss Rogers?
And she is now living with George Nation on Beach Drive.
Oh, yes.
He set up an apartment.
They were a file.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. But I've forgotten whether that girl was a Miss Rogers or whether she was a Miss Massey Gould. I don't know.
Well,
I think she was Miss Rogers, I'm not sure.
Yeah. So, anyway, Massey Goulden was on loan to the RCN, and that's the group you had in Halifax in about 1926 now we're getting on to.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Where do we go from there?
Yeah, well, I stayed there till early in 1929. I was sent back to the RN again, and I joined the Sussex in the Mediterranean. She was the first cruiser squadron, and this was her first commission. Beautiful ship. Roland Mingy was flag lieutenant to the admiral of the first cruiser squadron at that time. We spent our time in the Mediterranean around the Greek islands, and then we did a combined exercise with the home fleet in the winter.
Can you tell us something about the Roland Mingy of those days?
Well, he's a very up-and-coming fellow. He really did a job as flag lieutenant. And he was one of the bright lights in his department. He was a signal officer. He was quite a brainy fellow as well.
Yes. So you were going around to these ports you've mentioned?
Oh, yes. Oh, it was fine. In those days, we used to go to the Greek islands. We always did our regatta at one of these islands. I've forgotten which one it was. But they were lovely. And it was always great fun, those regattas, with all the cruisers and the destroyers and so on, the battleships out there.
And your base was?
Malta.
Malta and...
Valletta was the base for the capital ships.
Yeah.
And Salima Creek was the place for the destroyer.
Yeah. What about getting into there? It's rather like getting into a park, a very crowded parking lot, was it not?
God, yes. How those fellows ever managed. When I joined, we had a Captain Rakes. He wasn't there very long. He could handle the ship beautifully. And then we had another chap called Sawbridge, and I'd get critical about Captain Sawbridge. He could handle the ship. Nothing fazed him at all. He didn't worry him to go into Valletta at all. He'd handle the ship and turn it between the boys and so on. But he was more of a parson than he was a captain, almost. And he was very precise in what he did. He must have been awful pain in the neck to the commander, because he was so precise. And I was commander's mate of the upper deck in that ship, and things had to be just so, and when you did get them just so, he would want them changed just to suit himself. Another awful thing he had here is forever getting the shipwrights to carve beautiful fittings for the quarter deck, such as stanchions and so on. This was always a damnation when you went to sea. You had to remove all these slots and store them away. But it pleased him no end, and they were very beautiful when they were carved. But I didn't care for him very much. I don't think he cared for me at all.
Well, then it was mutual. He used to enjoy church service, you told me.
Oh, yes. This was a trouble was the troops who turned out in the Mediterranean, you turned out at 5:40 in the morning, and on Saturday there was so much scrubbing up to do to make the ship look tiddly for Sunday that you turned to at 5:30. On Sunday you had to lie in till 6:30. Well, the troops were up at 6:30, and then they got the ship all cleaned up nicely. And then we had to rig church for the old man. And invariably, having rigged church, he would come up and he'd say, "Yes, very well, boss, but I think we'll just change this round." Well, the troops were in their number ones at that time, and they didn't want to. They were very conscious of their dress, and they all did take great pride in their uniforms, and they resented it. I got around that all right, because I told the chief boatswain's mates we'd keep a little party of six that wouldn't go to divisions. They'd be hidden away so that they could do these changes, and that always worked out very well, and the captain never knew about this at all. These fellows, they were out of the way of the day, but he didn't seem to realize this at all, and they would do any changes that were necessary.
And Hans fell in for church at 0900?
Yeah, that's right. And then when he took prayers, we never got out much before midday. And he had various people he had trained up, and we knew they could sing, and so they were the choir, but they weren't together as a choir generally, as they were spotted around amongst the troops. The idea being that they would encourage the troops to sing, and whether this worked out or not. Anyway, they sang like silly all, and so did we all, so I guess this worked out well. And he was very pleased with himself, and he would have, well, at least half a dozen hymn tunes, but the tunes were that we knew them at all, he always would announce, but we'd sing this tune to some other hymn, or so he didn't know where you stood quite. He did.
So, what else should we say about that commission?
Well, I enjoyed that commission. The captain was Commander Tennant, and afterwards he was Sir William Tennant. And he was a magnificent fellow. I couldn't somehow do any wrong with him. He would always seem to be so pleased. Things would be all ready. He was married and living in Malta. He'd come off in the morning. He'd always be quite complimentary as to how the ship looked and so on, because I was always there at 5:30 or 5:40 in the morning. We really did have quite a clean, nice looking ship, I think. The troops were very proud of the ship.
Yeah. Well, you were talking a little earlier on about what the troops call the captain. Well, I met Sir William Tennant when he was CNCAW. I met him before that, but that's when I got to know him. And his troops called him Sir Bill.
Yes, yes.
In a term of affection.
Yes. All the troops loved the Commander Tennant. His night orders were really something worth reading. When we visited various ports, there was always a write-up in the night orders to what about these various towns that we visited, in the harbors, and there was always in the night orders what that had taken place that particular day and what we were going to do the next day, whether it was a regatta or whatever. And then there were all the parties that had to be detailed to do this and to do that. This was generally a couple of pages, but most interesting about the various ports that we visited and what the ship was doing. So the troops knew exactly what they were doing all the time, and they were thoroughly interested, smart as anything.
And these were posted all over the ship then?
Yes, it was Xerox. We had a Xerox machine. There were only a couple of times when I was told to write up the night orders, but they were really his night orders. He'd put down longhand just what should go into them. I had to just enlarge a little bit on this.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting, because I think he ended up first Sea Lord.
Yes.
Yeah.
But he went down, he lost the ship to the Repulse, and was Prince of Wales.
Yes, yes. Well,
later on, he came out here in the American West Indies Squadron, and I was reading this wasn't Reeve, I was counselor. And Reeve was invited on board to lunch. And his name was Bert Thomas, the Reeve at that time. And Bert and I saw eye to eye with each other. And he said, "Al, I'm going to be busy. Do you mind going to this luncheon?" The Admiral was getting a luncheon. And so I said, "Yes, I'd be glad to do this." And so I went down and I said, "How do you do?" He didn't recognize me at all at first. And Dutchie Edwards was invited too. And he called me Mr. Thomas. The Admiral called me Mr. Thomas. Dutchie whispered in his ear, "His name is Wirth." And he looked at me and he said, "My God, Wirth!" And I said, "Yes, I was your maid of the officer."
W-E-I-T-S, Wirth.
U-R-T-Z, they call
him. Wirth, W-E-I-T-Z, Wirth. So he didn't recognize you, yeah?
Oh, yes, that was.
So you must have talked about old times.
Oh, yes, yes. I enjoyed that very much.
Did he tell you what he thought of the captain's church services?
Oh, no, he was very loyal to it.
Yes.
He was very loyal to his captain, but he wrote me the nicest letter from when he left the ship. And this was to say that he realized that I had certain difficulties with Captain Salisbury.
Yes, well, that's...
But he was a brainy officer, Captain Salisbury, and certainly in exercises we did very well. And, but he came in the neck of the commander, and, well, was he paying the next me too?
Well, yes. If that's the worst we ever get from our captains, we're not,
we didn't suffer
very much. There's a lot worse than that that can happen to us.
I don't know what kind of a report he gave me. I was suspicious about that.
Well, sometimes it's just as well not to know. I think, it's nearly 1 o'clock and I've taken quite enough of your time and I think we've got an appointment to come back Wednesday anyway.
Yes.
So, I thank you again and I'll see you Wednesday.
Wednesday, okay.
About close.
Yes,
thank
close.
You. Just after I finished that bit of tape, we were talking and you said that you can go back even before there was a Royal Canadian Navy to a headline in the Ottawa Citizen.
Well, it was when the Canadian Navy first started up. The Canadian Navy started up, there was great controversy and politics interfered with the Navy of Gradian in those days. I think everybody will agree to that. There were two schools of thought, but eventually it was decided that Canada would buy two ships from the Royal Navy, the Niobe and Rainbow, and they did come out. But even the Army laughed at the small Canadian Navy of those days. We didn't have any personnel at all. Decided we would train up our own personnel. Well, this you cannot do in a matter of under 5 or 6 years, you make some descendants of a Navy by that time. And anyway, the Niobe came out and she banned by Royal Naval troops and officers. She went ashore off Cape Sable in Nova Scotia, and she was towed into Halifax by the Cornwall. And but when she went on the rocks, there was a sign on the citizen notice board in Ottawa, "Canada's Tin Pot Navy on the rocks." And that's what people thought about the Canadian Navy in those days.
Yes. Well, they think more highly of us now, but that's good to know that that's on the record. You were talking also, now that we're into this, that I mentioned that surely Admiral Malice was the first naval cadet, and you said no. He was in the Coast Guard. Or what did you say?
There were six young fellows that were taken on as cadets. They had no experience at all.
This was 1909 or so.
This would be 1910.
1910.
Yeah. They were taken on. There was Charles Tasher of Beard, there was Barry German, there was Victor Bourdieu, a fellow called Bate, a fellow called Wright, and Nellis, that I think is six. They were signed on as cadets. They did a certain amount of a very short time in little ships in Halifax. They went to a little ship called the Canada. And then they were sent off to do their proper training in the Dreadnought. And the Dreadnought was the pride of the Royal Navy at that time. And they really did, as I understand, a very good training. They made to do everything that they were really training in the Dreadnought.
Jackie Fisher's Dreadnought.
Yeah.
Now we will have lunch.
Okay.
So here we are again, looking out on the Wandafuca Straits the following day, November 3rd. And when you finished off, you were had just left Sussex in 1931. Can you go on from there, please?
Yes. The Sussex went home to pay off. This was her first commission, and she served in the Mediterranean. And when the ship paid off, we got a new crew and a new officer. And I served my time. I knew that I wouldn't want in the Sussex anymore, and I served my commission. And the department was that I come back to Canada. So I arrived back, I suppose it must have been in September of 31. I thought that I would be such a destroyer to have to see because I spent so little time in trips in the RCN, but I found that I was quite too overall. And first of all, that was